Good morning, everyone. We're going to get started. I'm going to go ahead and call to order the Senate Committee on Judiciary. We have a number of bills that are scheduled for public hearing and possible work session. We also had another one that was scheduled for work session today, which is House Bill 3450A. That one, we understand there is an amendment that has just been released yesterday, and so we are not ready to move that one forward unless we want to maybe adopt the amendment. But at this point, we're going to more than likely not work that bill since I believe my committee probably has not seen that amendment yet. So with that, we're going to go ahead and start with our public hearings. I do have, I see Senator Burdick here. Any other members? Senator Burdick, please remind me again, which one were you going to testify on?
House Bill 2865,
which is Mr. Taylor, since he's in the room. I'll let him get situated. I'm going to go ahead and open up a public hearing on House Bill 2865 for the purpose of getting Senator Burdick's testimony so she can go along with her other business in the Capitol.
Members of the committee, House Bill 2865A comes in Representative Garrett and Senator Burdick. A person who is personally injured or whose property is damaged as a result of using a trail that is in a public easement or unimproved right-of-way and who is on foot or on horse or bicycle or any other non-motorized vehicle does not have a negligence claim against the city with a population of 500,000 or more, or the officers, employees, or agents of the city owners on land abutting the public easement or unimproved right-of-way.
That's my one vote.
Is that a verdict? Yes.
Thank you.
And who is this?
Don Bach.
All right. And then there's another individual, Teja Dillman. Why don't you come up, too? That we'll just make a panel, and that way we'll just take
Great.
Everyone on this bill.
Thank you very much for your courtesy, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Ginny Burdick, and I represent the people of Southwest Portland, Tigard, and King City. I have to be careful how I phrase this, given that the committee membership here.
Your current district.
My current district. I always get this. I've got two members of the redistricting committee in front of me, and they're very picky how you describe your district these days. The district I currently represent. Anyway, I am here. I want to thank you for taking me. I will have to leave right after my testimony because I have someplace else I have to be. But I am coming here to discuss the importance of House Bill 2865 for my district specifically and for Portland in general. With me today is my constituent, Don Bach, and also others from the city who will be able to answer your questions. As many of you know, I'm a strong believer in creating walkable communities. I believe that individuals can feel more connected to their community and neighbors when they have the accessibility and connectivity of trails linking vital components of that community. House Bill 2865 is a tool for communities to strengthen and facilitate that neighborly interaction. The bill would reduce the liability of adjacent property owners to potential trails, making it easier to gain approval from these property owners to build these low-cost but serviceable connections. The A5 amendment to the Trail Immunity Bill extends the immunity that the bill provides to abutting landowners, to nonprofit organizations, and their volunteers for work on the trails. And I urge, this is a friendly amendment, and I urge the committee to adopt it. Colleagues, I live in an area where kids often take trails to schools. My constituent, Don Bach, who will testify in a moment, is personally responsible for thousands and thousands of person hours in building and maintaining trails, and he'll tell you more about it. This is a wonderful activity to encourage, and it's a wonderful thing to encourage our children and the residents of our communities to walk on these trails without putting adjacent landowners at risk. So with that, I will turn it over to the people who really know the facts on this, and but take any questions if you have any before I leave.
All right. Any questions for the senators? Thank you very much.
And thank you again, Mr. Chair.
Who would like to go next?
Thank you very much, Senator Burdick and Senator Prosnesky, and Chair and Senators. My name is Don Bach. I live in Hillsdale, Southwest Portland, where we have a lot of hilly terrain with a lot of unbuilt rights-of-way. The net result of that is we need to walk long distances to get through where you could otherwise go straight if you had the right kind of accommodations. It improves the safety of these cut-throughs by building trails. You've got in front of you a picture of a trail we built several years ago, about 3 years ago. The cost of a bridge across this area was about $900,000. We built the trail for about $10,000 and 325 man-hours. So this amendment or this change in the law will accommodate this kind of construction in many areas in Southwest Portland. And we really urge you to pass it. We have a large cadre of volunteers that are totally stymied right now with the liability situation, and that we cannot move forward without basically having a change in this law to be able to then move forward and with the building of key connections in the rights of way. You got questions? That's it.
All right, let's go ahead and get the rest of the testimony in.
Good morning, Chair Przemski and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to appear before you today. For the record, my name is Katya Dillman. I am the Transportation Policy Advisor to Mayor Adams, the Mayor of the City of Portland. I would like to thank you for giving the City of Portland the opportunity to voice our strong support for House Bill 2865 and the Dash 5 Amendment, which expands the immunity to nonprofit corporations and their volunteers for the construction and maintenance of trails and structures. The city, as you heard Senator Burdick mention and Don Bach echo, the City of Portland has an existing network of urban trails throughout the hills of Southwest Portland, and plans for more trail connections identified in the Southwest Urban Trail Plan. And many of these trail segments are along unimproved public rights of way. These unimproved public rights of way are actually streets that were never built. So they're paper streets. They're streets that appear on a map but were never pursued because of the topography of Southwest Portland. And many of these trails have been built or improved upon by citizen volunteers, primarily Southwest Trails, Inc., which is a nonprofit organization under the Southwest Neighborhood Coalition. And the existing trails are used both by residents for recreation and transportation, as you heard Senator Burdick testify to today, that kids use it to get to school. And folks use it in their neighborhood because the trails are because of the streets in Southwest Portland aren't a connected grid system. And so these trails provide opportunities for greater pedestrian connectivity, which is needed in that part of town. The problem, so currently property owners' immunity in the Oregon revised statute applies when trail users are recreating, and property owners and volunteer trail builders may be liable for damages if a trail user is traveling to a destination because it is considered transportation. So that's the inconsistency in the immunity currently, and that raises serious liability concerns among property owners and volunteer trail builders, which has brought trail building to a halt, and we believe that we need to continue these efforts to create greater connectivity and more livable and walkable neighborhoods in Southwest. So House Bill 2865 would provide the fix for this and would provide immunity from private action that is clear and consistent for property owners abutting trails along unimproved rights of way or through public easements. And the lack of certainty and concern around liability has had a freezing effect, and this would help us along. I would like to mention that the amended House bill applies only to Portland. This was done because Legislative Council raised concerns that providing immunity to landowners and to government, it runs a risk of being unconstitutional because an individual would not have anyone to sue. If it is unconstitutional, then the local government would be liable. And we're aware of this risk. We have a city attorney with us today, Mark Boleen, if you would like the opportunity to ask him further questions about this. But the City of Portland understands that there's some risk, and it understands that it's our risk. And we think it is worth it to encourage the public benefit from the availability of these trails in our urban areas. Thank you again for my opportunity today, and I'd be happy to answer any questions. Or April Berylson, the city's pedestrian coordinator, is here today, as well as Mark Moline, the city attorney for the city of Portland.
All right. So first, before we take questions, I just want to say you two were the only ones that were signed up. Was anyone else here actually wanting to give testimony or needing to give testimony? Because I want to get that in if we're going to ask questions so we don't go through that. All right, I'm not seeing anyone come forward. Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I might like to hear from the city's attorney, because I'm trying to follow this, I'm wondering if there, first of all, if there's some sort of story or something that I'm trying to read between the lines. I really appreciate what you're trying to do, but I'm trying to figure out what's underlying it. But if it's unconstitutional because it doesn't provide a remedy, I'm trying to figure out why the Dash 5 amendment would help that, because that also wouldn't provide a remedy.
If I could invite Mark Moline up, the city attorney, and while he finds his way up here, I would say that the city of Portland actually doesn't believe this to be unconstitutional.
I understand that it's an open question.
Mark, I need you to put your name on
the record. Oh, I'm sorry. Mark Moline with the city attorney's office of the city of Portland.
So that's, I think really what Senator Bonamici wants to do is establish and set a record, and I think it's important for us to do that because one of the questions I had also kind of was in this area with other representatives of the city as to who's going to actually potentially be on the hook for liability. And I think one of the issues, if I was a private landowner wanting to know, am I exposing myself to more risk as compared to, in this case, the city. So why don't we go through that?
Well, currently, the abutting property owner is responsible for maintaining the abutting right-of-way in a reasonably safe condition. And by our city code, they are primarily responsible. So if the city were to be sued today, we would, of course, tender our defense to the property owner, who would tender it to their insurance company, and hopefully that would take care of it. So, I mean, that's how it is today. One of the things I'd like to point out is the reason we're here is not so much that there is a real problem in the sense of a lot of lawsuits. As far as I know and as far as we the city knows as a whole, is there have been no lawsuits filed by anybody using these trails. The concern is more of a perception, and that's sort of the real problem, is that abutting property owners do not want to be liable for trails that are, I mean, a lot of these, as I said, were paper trails, paper rights of way. And so when the trails groups come through, they clean out the bramble, they make a nice trail for people to use, and that puts more people on the trail, and then the abutting property owners get nervous that more people could mean a lawsuit and that they would be liable. So that's really what we're trying to address today, sort of to allay those fears of the abutting property owners.
Okay. Other follow-up? Senator Bonamici? All right, let me ask a follow-up on my own. Knowing current law puts the property owner at, I'm going to say, at risk of being liable for anything that could occur if they don't maintain that area right away, do they have the authority to just say, I am restricting access to that right away at this point?
At this point, in order for the volunteers to come on and make improvements, including structures, they need the consent of the abutting property owner.
All right. And I assume in that context, the property owner could give them consent based on a waiver for those individuals coming onto the property to make these repairs, or entering into an agreement with the city that if someone is injured through their activities, that somehow the property owner would be able to shift their liability.
Correct.
All right. Other questions, Senator Cruz?
Two, if I could, Ms. Chair. I think one of them, if I'm assuming once they grant the right to do the improvement, there's assumed liability there because they allowed access. So that's one thing. But what I want, Ms. Chair, on the record, because originally this was a much broader bill narrowed down to just Portland, and what I would like on the record is why this doesn't work for small communities. I had it explained to me, but I'd like that on the record. So,
My understanding is that everybody acknowledges that under the current state of the law, there is a risk based on the Clark decision, but we think this is closer to the Brewer decision because there's trade-offs. People are getting access, which they would not normally have, real access. They're getting trails, which there's no obligation to build. And but clearly, and we don't know how a court will rule, but if the court were to decide along the lines of Clark, that would open up the liability to the public body. And my understanding is that the other jurisdictions did not want to accept that risk. But at the city, we're willing to accept the risk because we think it's minimal, and we think the law could change, and we have other arguments as well. And again, I think we think this is closer to the Brewer decision because of the trade-offs.
But I think there's also an issue that Portland did have these pre-plotted easements that don't exist virtually anywhere else, and so that's part of it as well.
That I don't know. David Barenberg is here from the city, and I think he had those discussions with the other jurisdictions, and so I would defer to David.
If I might add, while he's coming up, the improvements we're making many times is improving the safety of these routes. A lot of times they're very slick, muddy, and steep. We've had people fall, loose gravel, heavyweight people, really dangerous.
Chair Prozanski, Senator Cruz, I'm David Barenberg from the City of Portland. The city has plotted a lot of right-of-way that were plotted in the 18th century and just sort of plopped on a map. And I think, as Ms. Dillman said, you know, the topography wasn't looked at. As we were pursuing this bill, we haven't heard from a large number or many jurisdictions who were suffering from the same issue. There was interest in this. We spoke with Association of Oregon Counties, the League of Oregon Cities, their insurance risk attorney, and also with Oregon Parks and Recreation Association about their interest given the LC opinion about being included in legislation. And they prefer that Portland be the guinea pig if there were any challenges at this point in time. I think that the going back to the, you know, to the issue of why this bill is coming forward was again just the example of if I say to Don, let's go to, I'm going to the store, do you want to come with me? And both of us somehow were injured. Don, because he was going for a walk, couldn't sue. The landowner had immunity because he had a recreational use, but because I was going for transportation use to go to a store, that I could sue. And so that's the issue that has the landowner saying, we don't want to grant the, or we don't want to allow the volunteer groups to do any work on these trails.
We have 33 miles in southwest Portland alone, 33 miles of unbuilt right-of-way. That's about 8% of our total street network. So it's really, really important that we be able to use these.
Mr. Chair, I'm not opposed to the bill, but what comes up for a lot of us whenever we see legislation that's Portland only, that causes us to ask questions. And I appreciate the explanation.
Thank you. David, before you leave, I guess the other question, since you've had contact with other cities through the league, would it be appropriate to have it where another city could opt in if they wanted to?
Chair Prozanski, members of the committee, I think that that's a good option to allow people to knowingly assume the risk if they had an interest in doing so.
Okay. All right.
If Portland wants to be the guinea pig, let's let them.
That's an issue. Can't be where someone else wants it too. I mean, right. What I'm thinking is there are other cities that do, in fact, have these areas that are on paper, or actually in some areas where you would have a right-of-way for a street, but it has been barricaded at the ends, which is, then they have not, extinguished that right-of-way, so it hasn't gone back, and so.
Yeah.
I don't know if that or not, but okay. Any other questions for anyone on this? Thank you very much for coming forward. We're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 2865A, and
Well, what is, we're going to hold this one just for, we have the A5s that need to be adopted, but if we're going to include anyone else and opt in, I want to have that do that all at once. So what I'm going to ask is if, David, if you'd be so kind to get back to your counterparts at the league to see if that is something that needs or would be wanted, because there may have been some that were expressing it but kind of got left out on. And if they do, we'll do that. If not, we'll move this forward. All right?
We're missing the fiscal and A5 anyway. We got the revenue, but not the fiscal, at least in my packet.
Okay.
So, but that's fine.
All right, so that one is closed, and we're going to go ahead and go back to the top of the list. We'll start with the House Bill 2253A. Public hearing is open.
Chair Prezonsky, members of the committee, House Bill 2253A makes three real changes to, sort of varied changes to the powers of the Secretary of State and the filing of liens. First of all, in Section 1, currently, in order to file a what's known as non-possessory chattel lien, which is essentially a lien against services or labor or other materials, or agricultural produce liens, grain producers' liens, this must be made and notarized under oath. 2253 would allow a lien claimant to file the notice of claim in writing verified by an attestation under penalty of perjury, so basically just signing at the bottom as opposed to getting a formal notarization. Section 2 would allow the Secretary of State to register the deeds of public officials. And Section 3 pertains to the, it basically states that the Secretary of State will not be obligated to certify or notarize documents which essentially renounce allegiance to the U.S. government or claim sovereign jurisdiction against the laws of the state of Oregon, that sort of thing.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I've read Section 6 about a dozen times and I have no idea what it means. I wonder if the council could be a little more specific.
All right. So, Aaron, can you brief us on Section 6 of the bill?
Sure, just a moment. Who's our witness?
All right. Peter, why don't you come on up? Okay. Seems like this may be the council's lifeline, so...
You're going to call it lifeline?
You may be our council's lifeline today. We're going to see if you can give us the summary in your presentation regarding Section 6.
I'll give it my best shot.
Okay.
So, Chair Prezanski, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Peter Threlkell. I'm the director of the Secretary of State's Corporation Division. And I'd like to thank you for scheduling and hearing House Bill 2253 today. This is the bill from the Secretary to allow us to improve some of the services that our office provides so that we can serve the citizens of Oregon better by making some changes in the law. So the first five sections really deal with the simplification of the lien filing process. The ag services liens, agricultural produce liens, and grain producers liens are very important to our agricultural communities in the state. These are liens that as a farmer or grower allow them to deliver their product or commodity to an intermediary for sale. Farming is generally not a cash-based business, so the producers need the ability to offer terms and to receive credit or extend credit on their own, and also for service providers to be able to come and do work for the farmers have an assurance that they'll be able to be paid when the farmer gets paid. So. They file the liens with us today. We file thousands of liens every month. The vast majority of them are just signed by a simple, truthful statement. These three liens require some additional extra steps. We want to remove that, simplify the process, the ag community will be able to take advantage of online filing. They'll be able to file their liens faster and quicker. So Section 6 in the amended bill
the Dash A version. This deals with our authentication processes at the Secretary of State's office. So this is one of the duties that we have. We're the only office in the state where you can get a document authenticated for use in a foreign country. If it's a state document or document issued in the state of Oregon, it has to come through us to be authenticated. This is important because foreign governments require that our public documents have some authentication stamped on them so that they know that they're legitimate and they can be accepted in the foreign country. So what the current law allows is that the counties and courts can certify their own documents, and those documents are accepted prima facie in state courts. And what we're trying to do is allow the Secretary of State to recognize that as well, that if the courts can accept them without additional authentication, without additional certification, that we could. And that would streamline the process for our citizens. So the vast majority of those court documents right now, I would probably say 95-98% are certified, and then the document is used internally within the state or in this country. So for the very small percentage of documents that need to go outside the country, there's an additional step. The judge has to certify the document, and then it has to be notarized. A notary has to notarize it in the judge's presence for my office to be able to authenticate that. We would be able to remove that step because, quite frankly, what happens is for the small exception, those almost always get missed. So the citizen comes to my office with their document wanting it authenticated. It's not notarized. We have to send them back to the court. And so they get to make an extra trip back to the courthouse, go through the process again. It's extra work for the courts for a process that they just deal with on an occasional basis. But it really does create a problem for our citizens that need more of an expedited process to get these documents taken care of. So that's really – did that answer your questions on Section 6? And then the last part of the bill is really direction that we received from the U.S. State Department, and that's actually their wording. Came out to the states. There's a process if you want to renounce your U.S. citizenship. It's not through our office. It's not through an authentication process. That can be done otherwise. And so a lot of times what happens is someone would want to get the state seal on their document that made some type of claim that really isn't true. And a lot of times these are used as sort of immunity from laws. They get waved in the faces of our police officers all the time. Out on the highway, it creates a dangerous situation. The courts are tired of seeing them. The Secretary of State really doesn't want to be complicit in those efforts. We think it's best that we're just able to have clear authority to just reject them.
I would agree with that. I've prosecuted a number of these individuals before, and it's quite interesting how they say they're immune to any regulations of the state or the country. All right. Other questions or comments? All right. Thank you very much. Was there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on House Bill 2253A? Not seeing one, I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing. What we're going to do is on some of these, we're going to be coming back for possible votes today because I have a member who's currently not here that's supposed to be here in the next 15 minutes. And instead of going through the procedure of reopening it for another vote, we'll just do it that way. Okay. All right, so at this point, we're carrying on to our next one, which is going to be House Bill 2663A.
Chair Brzozinski, members of the committee, House Bill 2663A pertains to the rights of crime victims, makes two real modifications to the rights presently extended to crime victims. First of all, it modifies the existing consultation rights that exist between a crime victim and the district attorney's office. Crime victims already have the right to receive notifications about plea hearings, sentencings. This would add judicial settlement conferences as a triggering event that would require a district attorney to notify a crime victim. Also, it would require the district attorney to reconsult with a crime victim before a final plea agreement is finalized. Under existing statute, they're only required to consult once before the plea agreement is made. Secondly, it would extend the right of victims to make a request to either consider a release decision of a defendant or to allege a violation of one of their rights under this statutory section. Currently, crime victims are afforded only 7 days to make this sort of claim. House Bill 2663 would extend this period to 30 days.
All right, thank you. Doug, Steve, why don't y'all come up? While they're coming up, is there going to be anyone else who will want to give testimony on House Bill 2663A? All right. I think this is y'all too.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Steve Dole, Crime Victims United of Oregon. In 2008, the voters of Oregon overwhelmingly passed Measures 51 and 52, which this body referred to them, which made crime victims' rights actionable. In the 2009 session, this body passed Senate Bill 233, which set the framework in which those constitutional amendments could be construed. So these are just fixes that we found along the way that need to be done to Senate Bill 233. As Mr. Knott said, they're technical issues, and I have Professor Doug Blue from Lewis and Clark College along with me, who was very instrumental in passing Measures 51 and 52 and SB 233 to explain them more fully to you and why we need them and what they're for.
Mr. Chair, honorable members of the committee, these are fixes that are relatively predictable from Senate Bill 233.
Doug, I need to put your name on the record.
Oh, I'm sorry. Doug Baloof, professor of law, Lewis and Clark Law School. So what are they? Section 1 essentially is designed to reduce the number of claims victims would file for rights violations by requiring a colloquy between the court and the prosecution, ensuring that the rights were complied with. My understanding from the courts is that they are beginning to engage in doing this anyway in order to avoid error and mistakes. Are relatively uncontroversial. The whole bill is uncontroversial. So our bill does not conflict with what the courts are doing. I've talked to the courts and worked through it with them. Section 2 and 3, when Senate Bill 233 was enacted, we passed extremely conservative timelines because we weren't sure, you know, just what the impact would be. As it turned out, our timelines are so restrictive that victims essentially are precluded from remedy because from the time there's some rights violation to the time they have to complain about to the court is only 7 days. This seeks to extend that to 30 days. The important thing is this will not delay court proceedings. The Oregon Constitution, which provides victims' rights, which is what these procedures are designed to enable, indicates that rights will not delay ongoing criminal proceedings in any event. So what we're trying to do is increase the ability from virtually zero to some ability to file a complaint that a right's been violated. Also, we have just recently learned from the Department of Justice that there's some problems on the appellate side. Both these sections have to do, or the section 2 and 3 have to do with timing in the trial section. And it appears we need an amendment to extend some time on the appellate side as well, solve some timing of service issues, and give DOJ sufficient time to respond to an appeal, something that goes up to the appellate courts.
Okay. Questions? All right. Now I understand the amendments are getting worked on, so we'll put this off till another day for work session. And... anything else? All right, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2663A, and we'll open up our next public hearing on House Bill 2667A.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2667A removes from the Oregon Revised Statutes reference to ORCP 69B1, includes in those places ORCP 7C and ORS 105113 with the Oregon State Bar's phone numbers listed, the email address of the Oregon State Bar as well. Sets a filing fee for declaratory judgment action in an answer to the declaratory action at $117, applies to action filed after January 1, 2011, requires a clerk of court to refund fees already paid for declaratory judgment that exceed this amount, declares emergency effective upon passage.
All right, thank you. We have former Representative Billy Dalto. Billy, why don't you come on up? Is there anyone else who will want to testify on House Bill 2667A?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Billy Dalto, and I'm here today this morning to request that you move House Bill 2667 as engrossed to the floor, to the Senate floor for a full vote. As you heard from counsel, there are a couple of very minor provisions in the amendment in the bill that update phone numbers and statutory references. But what this bill also does is to attempt to remedy what I believe is an unintended policy error in the court fee bill the legislature passed during the 2010 special session. The fee bill, House Bill 3696, added court filing fees for each party named in lawsuits, whereas the previous fees were flat fees that were charged regardless of the number of people that were named in a lawsuit. While the legislature retained flat filing fees for small actions of $10,000 or less, irrespective of the number of parties involved, the legislature did not include declaratory judgments in that flat fee schedule. And this error has resulted in unintended outcomes where fees can, for these small matters and declaratory actions, can actually total more than the value of the matter at issue. House Bill 2667 corrects this error and restores the legislative intent of limiting fees in small matters by returning to the flat fee filing fee that we have now and crediting those who paid the excessive fee in 2011. I'm presenting a law student and a law clerk for a Salem attorney, and the subject of House Bill 2667 came to a head for me when I was reviewing the filing fees for a declaratory action for one of the cases my attorney mentor was set to file. As you know, a declaratory judgment is a form of relief that a party can request when they need a judge to make a decision about a contract or what party's legal rights or duties are. In double-checking the filing fees, I noted that a dispute that was over $381 was going to require an $1,182 filing fee just by our side because there were so many parties involved on a piece of restaurant equipment that touched many hands. I couldn't believe that the filing fee was so much for just a small but important matter. Ordinarily, the filing fee would have been $197, but because of the fee bill passed in a special session, the filing fee is now six times as much. The problem with a filing fee that high is that it acts as a substantial barrier to accessing justice. Most people would just say, it's $381, I'll let it go, because it doesn't make economic sense to pursue the matter. But some businesses out there are counting on the reality that people will just let these unwarranted fees go by, and we really don't want to make life easier for these bad actors. Sky-high filing fees merely perpetuate the kind of behavior that we have here. I've reviewed the matter with the Oregon Judicial Department, Judiciary Staff, and Legislative Council, and it seems clear to me that the legislature did not intend this unfair consequence of the fee bill. And my understanding is that this body will take up the matter in the court fee bill that's presently under consideration in Ways and Means. That's House Bill 2710. So that will aid future litigants, but it won't aid folks that are already engaged in the process right now for the first half of this year. I've worked with the Oregon Judicial Department to address any concerns they have on this measure. Based on the agency's feedback, we really narrowed it to a very small scope of folks, and those folks would have to apply for relief and do so within a 60-day window after this bill passes. So it's going to affect a very limited number of eligible parties. And the fiscal impact is minimal. It's about $5,000. So I respectfully request that you pass House Bill 2667 to the full Senate for a vote, and I'll entertain any questions you might have.
Great. Thanks, Billy. Any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't really have a question. As a senator, Witsit and I spent a lot of time over the interim serving on the Justice Systems Revenue Committee, and interim committee, and this is just one of the many things that we heard about, but not specifically. So I, the way I read this, it's not inconsistent with the bill, the bill that's in Ways and Means. Is that your understanding, counsel?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senator Bonamici, are we talking about the filing fee bill?
Yes.
I'm not that familiar with the details on that. If I do remember correctly, Mr. Dalto, it's jogging my memory a bit. I think we put something in that bill, or at least had a proposal to put something in that bill that was similar to this issue addressed here. And I think that was to avoid a potential conflict. So there was consistent policy in both packages.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonamici, if I may, yeah, two points to that. One, we did make sure that we put something in the Senate, in the fee bill, to make sure there wasn't a conflict with this bill. And the other thing is, at least anecdotally, I visited with the Judicial Department, and they seem just as concerned about this issue as I do, as I bring it forward. And so they're certainly interested in remedying this.
And I think if I could do a follow-up for the record, Mr. Chair, this really has two issues. It has to do with the multiple party fee, but it also puts the $117 filing fee in, and that's where I'm wondering about the possible inconsistency. So just for the record, I want to make sure that that's not inconsistent, because I haven't followed the changes that have been made in the court fee bill since the interim that went through the House. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you. Any other questions or comments? All right, thank you, Billy. We're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 2667A. I'll open up a work session on 2667A.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2667A to the floor.
All right, Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2667A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion.
Just for the record, Mr. Chair, I'll support the bill. I'm just hoping that this is not inconsistent with all the work that's been done on the fee bill, and we'll be watching for that when it comes through. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you.
Mr. Chair, from my perspective, this is something that definitely needs to be addressed. If you look at the, like for instance, a water right adjudication action, it can have pages and pages and pages and pages and pages of people. And if you have to pay a fee for each one of those people, it becomes horrendous. So, you know, I mean, this is a good fix.
All right. Any other questions? Any other comments? Any objection to the motion? Not seeing anyone. It passes. Senator Wissett, will you be our carrier on this one?
Sure.
Senator Wissett will be the carrier. We'll close House Bill 2667A. I'm now going to go back up to do a work session on 2253A, since we now have all the members here. And this is the one that we dealt with on the liens with the this one here.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, House Bill 2253A to the floor for due pass recommendation.
All right, Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2253A to the floor for the due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Cruz, will you carry this one?
Okay.
Senator Cruz will be our carrier. We'll close the work session on 2253A, and we're going to now go ahead and open up our next public hearing, which is on House Bill 3034A.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, House Bill 3034A pertains to the deferral of jury service and makes two changes. First of all, House Bill 3034A specifies that only one deferral of jury duty will be allowed except upon a finding of good cause. Any person requesting an additional deferral would be obligated to provide a list of no fewer than 10 dates within the six-month period immediately following the date of that request on which the person would be absolutely available to serve as a juror. The second second change is House Bill 3034 would require that no employer be permitted to compel an employee serving on a jury to use their accrued vacation leave, sick leave, or annual leave in responding to that jury summons and must be permitted unpaid leave.
All right. Deborah, you're signed up. Please come forward.
Chair Prusansky, members of the committee, Deborah Heron on behalf of the Oregon Liability Reform Coalition, and with me today is Thomas Cuomo's staff for Representative Andy Olson, and I'd like to defer to allow him to go first, as Representative Olson is one of two sponsors of the bill, along with Representative Mike Schaffler.
Chair Prusansky, members of the committee, again, my name is Thomas Cuomo. I'm here on behalf of Representative Olson, state representative out of the Albany area, and he just wanted me to briefly convey his thoughts on this bill. This bill comes to you from the House where it was passed 56-0. House Bill 3034 is a bill that deals with jury service. It is a common sense bill that was passed 2 years ago, which was then House Bill 3171, but it simply ran out of time. Basically, this bill gives the authority to a judge to say no to deferrals for jury duty. There are times when courts simply run out of jurors, and that can create a big problem for both the civil and criminal cases. House Bill 3034 allows a judge or clerk to consider more than one deferral of jury duty for a good cause. A person requesting a deferral under this provision must provide a list of 10 dates or more within the six-month period following the date of the request on which the person would be available for jury duty. Additionally, this bill makes it very clear a citizen who dutifully exercises their obligation as a citizen can't be penalized by their employer for being called to service. Essentially, they can't be forced to take out vacation leave, sick leave, or other leave for their absence. This bill brings some clarification for the courts, the court and jurors. Thanks for listening, and I hope you strongly consider moving this bill to the Senate floor. And in closing, Rep. Olson wanted me to point out that there were no smiley faces on his letter this time.
We also noticed that you read it into the record, so we'll let you out on this one. Next time, we'll want you to summarize with a smiley face.
Okay.
Deborah?
Chair Prusansky, members of the committee, again, Deborah Heron on behalf of the Oregon Liability Reform Coalition. We support House Bill 3034A. We believe that people have a right to a jury by their peers and that this bill would allow strengthening of the jury pool by providing surety to both sides of the equation. It lets court clerks know when people can show up for jury duty, and it lets those of us who get called for jury duty, if we do need a second deferment, to look at our own calendars and commit to dates that we know that we can be available. The committee staff have summarized the nuts and bolts of the bill, so I'll just leave it for questions if you have any. In working the bill this session, we have talked to the Judicial Department, to the DAs and others that would have an interest in what happens in jury pools, and have met with no opposition, and in fact most have said that the bill's on their tracking list and they have no questions, comments, or concerns.
All right.
Thank you.
Any questions? No questions. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill. Well, first let me just ask, I didn't ask this earlier. Was there anyone else who wanted to testify on 3034A? Not seeing one, we'll close the public hearing for the work session on 3034A.
Mr. Chairman, House Bill 3034A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
All right. Senator Cruz moves House Bill 3034A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And the chair will carry 3034A. And we'll close the work session, and we're wrapping up a public hearing on House Bill 3068.
Chair Prusansky, members of the committee, House Bill 3068 would permit the Court of Appeals to take appeals from municipal or justice courts that are considered to be courts of record. Presently, the Court of Appeals are permitted to take appeals only from circuit courts.
All right, thank you. And Alan?
Yes. Chair Prusansky, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Alan Rapelier. I'm the city attorney for the city of Beaverton. I'm here on behalf of the city. I want to thank you for hearing this bill, and thank you for flexibility of hearing this bill today. It was scheduled yesterday, and there was a little miscommunication, so I was able to come down, so I certainly appreciate that. So again, it seems like today was a day for sort of judicial fixes, and this is another judicial fix. Several years ago, the legislature enacted a law that allowed municipal courts and justice courts to become courts of record. record. And basically that allows them to be very similar to circuit courts. And prior to that bill, all municipal courts and justice courts, they if they didn't like what the judge did, then they had to do a de novo appeal at circuit court, basically to get the whole trial all over again. With the enactment of the court of record legislation, we were treated like circuit courts and you went directly to the Court of Appeals. Anyway, this last year we found a little thing that was omitted from that legislation, and that's what we're here today to fix. And that was a situation where there was a Court of Appeals ruling in Machuca versus the State of Oregon where the Court of Appeals basically tossed out the breathalyzer tests. And so across the state, so there were a number of these cases pending, including three in Beaverton Municipal Court, where the judges were, based on that precedent, had to toss out or exclude from evidence the breathalyzers. So across the state, the district, you know, the Attorney General took those cases on an interlocutory appeal so they could take it to appeal to the Court of Appeals before there was a final decision, while the Machuca case was pending before the Supreme Court. And so when the Supreme Court reversed the Machuca and basically said, no, those breathalyzers can be allowed into evidence, all those cases in circuit courts were allowed to go forward and reintroduce that breathalyzer evidence, whereas in the municipal courts and justice courts who were courts of record, then we were not allowed to do that because there is a statute that says there's no interlocutory appeal in those cases. So this is just a minor fix to allow that, to prohibit that sort of you know, small miscarriage of justice. And I'm here to answer any questions.
Thank you. Any questions? Not seeing anyone. Is there anyone else who wants to testify today on House Bill 3068? Not seeing anyone. We'll close the public hearing or open a work session on 3068.
Mr. Chairman, move House Bill 3068 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 3068 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussions? Any objection? So ordered. Chair will carry 3068. We'll close the work session on 3068. And I believe at this point that's going to conclude our work today. Regarding House Bill 3251A, we carried it over yesterday. I have not had the opportunity to have some discussions I need to have with members on the House. So what we're going to do is we will reset this. This will be reset for work session. Since we've already had a public hearing on this bill, we will not need to have a public hearing on it in the future, and we'll get it posted. And as I said earlier, we are holding on House Bill 3450A because there's an amendment that was just released last night or yesterday afternoon, and we need to make certain everyone has a chance to look at it and we get the paperwork that needs to go with it. So with that, we, let's see, tomorrow is Thursday. We're here at 8:30, if I'm not mistaken, so we'll be adjourned today until tomorrow.
Chair, and you didn't vote on any earlier.
Okay. We waited for you.
Our
circle, our world went around, as you can see how efficient we were.
Yeah.
So we're here tomorrow, Thursday, May 19th at 8:30. Thank you.